The Social Detective is a true crime podcast meant for adult audiences. Some material might be explicit, contain adult language and descriptions of crimes that aren't suitable for young or sensitive listeners. The contents of this podcast are for educational purposes only. We do provide sources in our show notes for further research for our listeners. We also provide our opinions, which we state in the podcast. We will never post, theorize, or provide information that would endanger a case for the victims, families, or law enforcement. We refuse to sensationalize cases to gain listeners. This podcast will always be a safe space for the families of the victims.
Welcome to Shatsunami, a variety podcast that discusses topics from gaming and films to anime and general interests.
Previously on Shatsunami, we've analysed what makes a good horror game, conducted a retrospective on Pierce Brosnan's run as James Bond, and listened to us take deep dives into both the Sonic and Halo franchises.
Also, if you're an anime fan, then don't forget to check us out on our sub-series, Shatsunani, where we dive into the world of anime. So far, we've reviewed things like Death Note, Princess Mononoke, and the hit Beyblade series.
If that's sounds like your cup of tea, then you can check us out on Spotify, iTunes, and all good podcast apps.
As always, stay safe,
stay awesome, and most importantly,
stay hydrated.
Hey guys, it's Marianne, Dog Mom, Baker, True Crime Podcast Maker. Today we're going to discuss a case that changed the landscape of how missing children were handled. The case of Kevin Collins. Kevin Collins' case gained national attention as one of the first missing children to appear on milk cartons and on the cover of national publications, such as the Newsweek magazine in 1984. His abduction from the San Francisco streets helped bring to light the plight of missing and exploited children in the United States. But now, after 40 years, Kevin has faded in the public's memory. With over 350,000 kids reported missing in the United States in 2022, it's hard to keep track of the multiple children that are lost. Until cases are either solved and the children are returned home to their family, or we learn of other horrendous fates. Then we remember, oh my gosh, yes, we remember that case. Usually the only ones who keep cold cases alive are the family or other loved ones of the missing or the victims. But in Kevin's case, someone had not been able to forget about him. Even though when Kevin went missing, he was just a child himself. Today, we're going to share a conversation we had with filmmaker Andrew Kappel. Andrew worked with Investigation Discovery previously, so he's not unfamiliar with the true crime genre. But it was Kevin's case in particular that caught his attention and his heart. Before we share that interview, I want to touch on Kevin's case. For any of the listeners that might be unfamiliar with it or need a refresher. Kevin Collins was born in San Francisco on January 24, 1974, to David and Ann Collins. Kevin was one out of their nine children. It was a very bustling and very busy household. On February 10, 1984, at 10 years old, Kevin was a fourth grader at St. Agnes School in the Height Ashbury District. He struggled a bit because he had dyslexia and he was quieter than most of the other kids. Kevin had gone to basketball practice after school, but he decided to leave early. Several people say they had seen him leave the school's gymnasium between 6:10 and 6:30 p.m. that night. One of his older brothers, 11-year-old Gary, normally would have accompanied Kevin to basketball practice, but that one day, Gary was homesick. The last time Kevin was seen was around 7:55 p.m. at the corner of Oak Street and Masonic Avenue. He was waiting for the number 43 bus. Witnesses reported seeing him at the bus stop talking to a tall, blonde-haired man with a big black dog. After that, he was never seen or heard from again. Amber Alerts weren't established until 1996, when 9-year-old Amber Hagerman had gone missing. Her murder still goes unsolved today. Prior to Amber Alerts, broadcast and print media were the only way to inform the general public of a child's disappearance. Following the evening of Kevin's disappearance, posters with his picture were distributed and displayed on telephone poles and storefront windows around San Francisco. Notably, a missing poster featuring Kevin Collins inadvertently appeared in the 1984 film The Terminator, which was filmed and set in California. It can be seen pinned to a board on the left of the screen as Paul Winfield's character is shot during the police station shootout. The poster also appears in the 1984 movie A Nightmare on Elm Street during another scene in a police station. In the days that passed, billboards, milk cartons, and national magazine covers showed Kevin's picture. It circulated nationwide as the country searched for Kevin. This, along with the development of a 1983 television movie about the kidnapping and murder of Adam Walsh, helped spark nationwide interest in the plight of missing children. Parents were now becoming educated on how to better protect their children from stranger abductions. Law enforcement personnel were learning how to better coordinate their efforts in response to child abductions. The strain of Kevin's disappearance and the search for their son was difficult for David and Anne, and it led to their divorce. On November 14th in 2005, an identity thief, he ended up pleading guilty because he tried to steal Kevin Collins' identity. For a while, they thought, hey, maybe we had found Kevin Andrew Collins. But he was just trying to obtain a passport. And the family was left to another dead end. In our interview with Andrew Kappel, we're going to discuss new developments in 2013 that were had by the San Francisco Police Department's Cold Case Unit. They reopened the case and they told the family they believed they found a viable suspect. Wayne Jackson, a convicted pedophile who lived down the street from the school. Police had questioned him in 1984. On January 29th, 2013, police served a search warrant on Wayne Jackson's house in the 1100 block of Masonic Avenue. The concrete floor was removed because cadaver dogs had indicated the possible presence of remains. However, preliminary reports indicated the remains happened to be from an animal, not human. And this is where the case has stalled and lingered. The family is still waiting for answers, and their mind falls to anything. What is it that could have happened to Kevin? Andrew Kappel has wondered the same thing, but he's taken his questions to the next level, and he's trying to help Kevin's family find the answers. So let's go on to the interview with Andrew Kappel. Amazing person actually reached out to me, and he's making a difference in this case, and he's trying to help the family find answers. And I'm going to introduce you to Andrew Kappel. And he's going to talk to you about how the case came to him and what he has actually done in the true crime world. So let me introduce you to Andrew.
Hi, Marianne. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. So my background, I started working on this case 5-6 years ago. I'm a documentary producer by trade. And I was working at a production company up here in the Bay Area. And I was actually working on one of those investigation discovery shows. We've probably all seen, I'll leave the name out of it for this, but we've all seen the show, very popular on ID. And I was just, you know, a lot of my job at that time was just doing research, right? Finding cases for the show. And I came across an article that had been written about a year prior to my, my research. And it was about a bone discovery in a planter box outside of an apartment building in San Francisco. And they were a child's bones. In the article, they actually referenced that this might be a link to the missing child, Kevin Collins, from 1984. And I flashed back immediately to my childhood. I was only two when Kevin disappeared, but I do remember, you know, him being on milk cartons. I remember the Stranger Danger conversations with my parents, and it was just all over the news. It brought me right back to that. And I thought to myself, like, you know, whatever happened with this case? And I quickly learned, you know, I quickly started just reading about the case more and diving into the research and realized quickly that they had reopened the case and named a prime suspect, but they had passed away and that there was just never any resolution to this case. You know, Kevin went missing in 84. And now even today, 40 years later, there's no resolution. You know, they don't know what happened to him. He just vanished. After I started like doing some research, I just thought, you know, on a whim, I'm just going to reach out to the Collins family and just kind of just talk to them and just see, you know, see what they know, see if there's been any new developments since the articles have been written. And I quickly developed a relationship with them, a very nice family. Laura and Michelle are his oldest sisters, and they're sort of the spokespeople for the family. And I communicate with them every month now. You know, we've sort of become pen pals. We Zoom all the time. We FaceTime. We text often. I've become friends with the family. I interviewed them a couple of times over Zoom, and they're just sort of, you know, fed up with the fact that they just have never been able to get answers. You know, the SFPD reopened the investigation in 2013. They named a prime suspect, this man who went by several names. They knew him at the time as Wayne Jackson, but then he passed away under the name Dan Therrien. Anyways, he had a bunch of different aliases. They reopened the case, named him as a suspect, but he had passed away in 2008, 5 years prior to them opening the case. So, they realized after that he had a partner named Jack Chow. If you've been following the case, you know,
Can I interject things real quick? They did bring cadaver dogs to his house, correct? As a cadaver dog mom. They did bring cadaver dogs to his home, and those dogs hit in the garage area, yes. If I'm remembering the case.
That's right. Yeah. In 2013, they went back to the home that Dan Therrien and Jack Chow lived on Masonic and Page, which is right near the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco. And they brought cadaver dogs, and the dogs hit on the garage. And so this was really exciting for, you know, investigators. Everybody was just like, you know, high-fiving, like, this is it. This is our moment. We found him. Turns out it was just animal bones. Like someone just buried your dog in the garage, unfortunately, or something like that. To that effect. So swing and a miss on that one, unfortunately, but they did find out that, you know, his partner, Jack Chow, went back to Canada after Dan's passing.
Okay.
So they're like, well, we need to talk to this guy. You know, if he was with them at the time Kevin was missing, he likely knows something. So cold case investigators went up to Canada. They found Chow, they talked to him, but he stonewalled him. He wouldn't say anything about the case. And the Collins family even gave immunity to Jack in the event that he was involved. We don't know that he's involved. We're not saying that he was involved in the case. But they do feel like he knows something. So they offered immunity to him, you know, to just so he would talk. Still wouldn't talk. Police gave him a lie detector test. He failed the lie detector test. When they asked him every question about Kevin, he failed every question. So there's no doubt, I think, amongst everybody that Jack knows what happened. He just has been, you know, been quiet up to this point. And the last time police talked to him was about 10 years ago. And it's my goal to find him and, you know, put a camera in front of him or put a microphone in front of him and just see what he'll say. See if he'll talk to me. I'm not coming with the police behind me. I'm not coming with the threat of incarceration or anything like that. I'm just coming with a plea from the family that they just want to know what happened to Kevin. And if this guy knows, the time is now.
Right. And there's no physical evidence that the police have. We have is this guy.
That's it. That is it. There's no physical evidence. There was really no witnesses at the time. And, you know, in the 80s, you know, we didn't have cameras. We didn't have social media. It's unless you saw someone do something. It was a lot easier to get away with crime back then. You know, that's why it was the heyday for serial killers. That's why so many missing kids went missing back then. You know, there wasn't the Amber Alert system. You know, we didn't have all this technology. So if you were gone, that was it. You were gone.
Right.
Right.
I just wanted to clear up because there are a couple of podcasts that I did listen to that are out there. I'm not going to name them, but some of them try to say that there is some physical evidence or bones that anthropologists are trying to identify. And I just wanted to clear up that is not correct, that those were animal bones. There is no physical evidence available in this case.
Well, so in 2013, they dug up the garage. Those were animal bones. That is correct. The article that I'd mentioned that I came across when I first started doing research was of a new bone discovery in a planter box outside of an apartment building that were a child's bones. Those bones still haven't been identified, and I've asked the SFPD about that. They won't tell me yes or no regarding that. But I imagine if it was Kevin, it would have been announced. We would know likely.
Yeah.
But there, you know, because the case is still active, because the case is still open. They won't divulge any of that information to me.
Okay.
So there's no real evidence in this case beyond that. I mean, you know, right. there's no prime suspect's dead. There's no DNA possibility because Kevin's remains were never found. So, you know, we just don't know.
And what we've seen, the highest ability to get someone who does have actual tangible the ability to know something, somebody who has been in that man's life, is this Chow person, correct?
Yeah, Jack Chow. Yeah, they were. So a little bit that I've learned about them, they are from Canada, from like the Vancouver, Whistler. I don't know exactly what city, because, you know, we're talking about 50 years of records now, but they're from somewhere up there. The partner, this Dan Therian character, was getting arrested for molesting two 13-year-old boys up there in like 1974. Okay. He was getting ready to go on trial or go to jail. I'm not exactly sure, but I know that he was named as the suspect in two 13-year-old boys molestations. So what did they do? They fled the country. They got out of there and they came to San Francisco. Him and Jack Chow together. They were together then. So they came to San Francisco. This Dan Therian guy molested a boy on Fisherman's Wharf, which is a very popular tourist attraction for those of you who don't know in San Francisco. He got caught for that and got arrested and went to jail. Okay. He got out of jail and changed his name and was able to fly under the radar doing that. Back then you could change your name and you know, you just tell the police you're a different name, you get a different ID. It was really easy to fly under the radar back then. And so Chow was with him during all of that. And then Kevin goes missing a block from where they live. One eyewitness did say that they saw Kevin at that bus stop talking to a man with a large black dog. Therian had a large black dog. So that was one of the things that cold case investigators honed in on when they reopened the case. They knew he was in close proximity, the dog link. There's a couple different things like that that made them zero in on him. And then once they realized that he was using an alias that whole time and that his real name was Therian and from Canada and that whole thing, they're like, okay, well, this is our guy. And that's what made them, of course, then want to talk to Jack Chow and all of that. So, yeah.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I think the family has run into some frustration with the police department because the police department feels like they have their guy, but Kevin's no longer here. The guy's no longer here. And Chow has pretty much beat it out of town. So the family's feeling some frustrations and they're not getting answers.
That's right. Yeah. You know, they're basically the Collins family are sort of at an impasse because SFPD feels that they got their guy. They know. Well, they didn't get him, but they know they named their suspect. They think they know who did it, right? He's passed away, and they can't do anything about the Chow situation because there's no evidence that Chow was involved in the disappearance of Kevin. He was a partner, maybe an accessory at best. We don't know for sure. But you know, without any kind of physical evidence that he was actually involved in Kevin's disappearance, there's no way the Canadian government's going to extradite Chow here. You're not going to go through all that for something that's extremely circumstantial with zero evidence. So that just leaves the Collins family in such a tough spot where SFPD is not actively working the case because there's nothing new happening. And they feel like they got their guy, but because there was never a prosecution and because Kevin was never found, they can't close the case. So it's still considered open, maybe not extremely active, but it's open. So they're not giving me information because it's an open investigation. It's a really weird situation. And it's just really frustrating for everybody that's sort of trying to pursue it.
Right. And that's something I run into a lot whenever I'm talking about a cold case. The first thing everybody always asks me is, well, did you do a FOIA? Well, even on a cold case, they're not going to give you the information because it's still labeled an open case. So it's not that easy to get the information. And you've been working on this case for how long now?
Like 6 years. Yeah, 6 years.
And Kevin's mom is how old now?
Yeah. Kevin's mom, when I first reached out to them, she was in her early 80s. And this was like 2016 or 2018, 2017, 2018. So she's in her late 80s, maybe pushing 90 now. And Michelle and Laura did mention to me that, you know, there's maybe some dementia starting to happen. And so I've always felt like this ticking clock. I want to find answers for his mom more than anyone in the world. She just deserves to know what happened to her son.
Yeah.
You know, she deserves to know. He disappeared one day and that was it. And we're never going to give her answers. It's just such a disappointing thing. It's so sad. And such a, you know, I don't want to use the term miscarriage of justice, but I don't feel like there's everything, every rock was not unturned on this case, is my opinion.
And it's something I've always said, even with Krista's case, we never get closure, but just to have a friggin' answer to one piece of the puzzle is so important. And for you to devote so much time to just finding any little piece of this puzzle means so much, I can guarantee, to this family. And you're not doing this alone, right? You've got some help in this.
Yeah. So when I first started, I was sort of on my own. I had a producing partner at the time who was kind of helping me with some of the research, but he got bogged down with some things. So I just kind of just took this over on my own. And then took this to some colleagues of mine up in Toronto, who have a production company. They're called 5-7 Films. And I've been working with them closely over the last several years. They've been helping promote, they've been helping with resources to a small extent, and just, you know, really just helping with support of the project, which, and then, you know, this last year, I've really been able to like dive in more with more free time, make it more of a full-time effort. And that's when I brought on our private investigator. His name is Axis Vero. He's based out of Vancouver, but has offices all over Canada. He has about 25 employees. And he was kind enough to, you know, offer some services pro bono for me, as much as would allow. You know, he's got a lot of active cases that he's working with his teams that are paying clients that he can't really pull away from. But he is helping to the extent that he can. We're definitely working with him. But we did set up a GoFundMe account to, you know, try to raise some money so we can help support the investigation. I think if we were able to put some money behind his investigation, we would be able to use the whole breadth of his team. We'd be able to do some like real surveillance. It's a lot of man hours to do that kind of surveillance, but we'd be able to like really do some real surveillance and find out if Jack, where he is, and, you know, if he's alive. We're hoping he's alive still. And then, you know, there's a lot of money in the cost of, you know, pulling records and you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, that's where all the money would go. And then also, you know, if if in fact he is alive and we can find him and we can send a production team up there to set up cameras and he agrees to do an interview, funds will be funneled that way as well. So this is, you know, if anything's left, I want to give it to the Collins family, you know, for
you know,
pain and suffering for 40 years. I mean, you can't really pay
that. Yeah. But
it'd be nice to give them something.
Oh, definitely. And that would be incredible. And so people are, and one of the really cool things is, and this is one of the things that I always like to say that sets my podcast out from everyone else's. And this kind of was something we saw in Krista's case, as you guys are out there and you guys are listening, my social detectives, you guys become a part of the case. You guys interact, you guys try to help. And this is a chance for you guys to come on board. This is a chance for you guys to help. Andrew, you're available on other platforms besides Instagram. Where else can my listeners be a part of this and help out?
Yeah, that's great. Well, we're posting, you know, everything initially on Instagram. I know it's circulating around Facebook as well. We don't have a real dedicated Facebook page to the Milk Carton Kids, you know, campaign that we're putting together. But we are circulating around on TikTok as well. And I'll make sure to share all those links with you and your listeners as well.
Okay. And so we'll definitely want to share that. I want you guys to try to help and be a part of that. And I'll also find a way to share and be a part of this on Reddit as well. And maybe we can create some noise over there, because I know you guys love to make noise on Reddit. So very active group we have over there.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that Kevin's mom gets some answers. And this is absolutely incredible what you are doing. And we just want to know, is there anything else that we can do? Anything else you want to leave us with that we can do to make a difference, help be a part of this case, help raise the platform? Anything else we can do?
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, you know, like you hit the nail on the head. I think the most important thing is just, you know, sharing, liking, you know, supporting the cause. If you can, you know, find it in your heart to, you know, donate any kind of financial sum to this GoFundMe, I think we can find Jack Chow faster that way. We're going to find him regardless, but the money, if we can put some funds behind that effort, for the investigation team that's up there in Vancouver, then we'll be able to get to him a lot quicker than just, you know, this boots on the ground grassroots effort that I've been doing thus far. So I think, you know, sharing it, liking it, supporting it, you know, as much as you can is the best thing, best and only thing that we can really do at this point. We're talking about a case that's 40 years old. So, you know, that's really, you know, I think the Collins family appreciate everybody just talking about it and keeping his name circulating. I mean, that's the most that they can hope for. That's the most I can hope for, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the biggest things is with this case, it sounds like the police worked it. And then once they feel like they had something, Kevin was lost. He continued to not only be a missing person, he became a lost child. And that is so sad for the family. And remember, as I always say, we are not a bystander podcast. We get involved and we become a part of that case, and we are going to do what we can to help drive this case forward, and let's help get answers faster. So I want to see all of you guys on board. Let's see what we can't do to make a difference. So remember, we're going to get this. I'm going to tag this. We'll have it in our show notes as well. So stay with us, keep following, and remember, act, advocate, and share. Thanks for listening.
Sources for this podcast are in the show notes if you would like to research this case further. Remember, it's not only the work of investigators that solves cases. It's the social media platforms that reminds the victims' families, as well as the person or persons who committed these crimes, that we haven't forgotten. We keep the victims' cases and faces in the forefront to get them solved. The Social Detective is a true crime podcast meant for adult audiences. Some material might be explicit, contain adult language, and descriptions of crimes that aren't suitable for young or sensitive listeners. The contents of this podcast are for educational purposes only. We do provide sources in our show notes for further research for our listeners. We also provide our opinions, which we state in the podcast. We will never post, theorize, or provide information that would endanger a case for the victims, families, or law enforcement. We refuse to sensationalize cases to gain listeners. This podcast will always be a safe space for the families of the victims.